Welcome to North Pod Law, Series 6, Episode 3. Recorded on the 10th of October 2012, Spouses and Houses.
We are blessed with an abundance of people at podcast hours today, aren't we?
We are. We have a silent partner, but we also have an expert, I think. I think we could rightly call you an expert.
Yeah, a non-silent partner.
Absolutely.
We could certainly call you that.
That is Terry Fox, who avid listeners will remember from last week's show. He was our caller, and he joins us today for a wholly different purpose, actually, to do with Pocker. That is, yes, you're not hearing things, ladies and gentlemen, that is the Pocker show that we have been trailing since Series 1. Well, it's now finally come to fruition, unless anything goes horribly wrong during the course of the next hour or so.
Can I just set everybody's minds at ease that if you do tweet us or send us a message, you don't necessarily finish up being dragged onto the show the following week to display your expertise.
Well, you can work out the statistics as to how many what percentage chance there is that you will, but I think it's fairly high. And yes, we have a silent partner who we may try and coax onto a microphone.
She's shaking her head. She's shaking her head.
She's having none of it, is she? All right then, so what's going on this week's show, Kirsten?
Well, it's really all about the Tory Party conference, isn't it? Because it's all about what might be happening in the future, and they are in charge at the moment.
No one's making anything up this year, apparently.
Apparently not. We have got, I'm sure everybody's heard about this, the new potential new law in place. Really, it's the idea is that they're going to try and clarify an old law in terms of defending your home.
You say that because whether it's clarification of old law or for the first time ever since these, this gets proposed every year, doesn't it? But there sounds
promising
like
they're going to do it.
There sounds like an actual change coming this time around, which I think, given Terry's former employment, as he disclosed on our voicemail last week, might be something of interest. So we'll come to that in a bit.
And then there's also Theresa May has announced that she would like victims to have more say in the sentencing of offenders. That's actually the specific victim of the crime concerned, and in particular in ASBO cases, in antisocial behaviour cases.
It's Groundhog Day, listeners. We've covered victims and victims' charters and stuff on I don't know how many shows, but again, there's further developments and perhaps of some substance this time.
We might discuss a couple of other things and give you a bit of a heads up on the duty solicitor slots, but I think first we should turn to Terry.
We should indeed, and just in case you're wondering, listeners, where Jonathan is for the third week in a row, I think, of this series.
Well, we just wouldn't post bail for him.
Exactly. Well, no, I think he's been released from the Thai prison, and he was supposed to be coming here. He's not quite made his way here yet.
Yeah, he just can't be bothered. He's just got used to the life of luxury in a Thai prison, hasn't he? That's what it is.
Indeed. Right, so serious matter of the Proceeds of Crime Act, and more specifically confiscation proceedings. Some considerable years ago, the governments of the world in various different places decided that it probably wasn't right that if somebody committed a criminal offence from which they made some sort of profit, that they should be able, upon release from prison, assuming they were ever put in prison, to have that money back one way or another, to dig it up from wherever it was hidden.
Didn't seem very fair that they all had lots of racehorses when they came out. I think that was the general feeling.
Yeah, the public was a little bit miffed by it, I think it's fair to say. And the United Kingdom, being one of those many places that decided they ought to do something about it, came up with a piece of legislation called the Proceeds of Crime Act. Now, the Proceeds of Crime Act, in practice, is designed to strip people of criminal assets at the conclusion of criminal proceedings. You may think, well, that seems perfectly sensible, but when you hear the words proceeds of crime taught by lawyers, you quite often hear the expression draconian legislation following pretty shortly thereafter. What do we mean? Why is it draconian? What are the problems? Terry Fox, first of all, so listeners know a little bit about you and why you have come to tell us about this. You're a former police officer, I think.
I am, former detective chief inspector, served in all the major crime suites. Retired quite some time ago. I'm quite old now. Retired in 1995, after 30 years. I'm still working, running a little company now, which aids solicitors in achieving certain objects.
There's a company called LRS.
Yes.
Which stands for?
Legal Review Services.
Now, a significant proportion of the work that LRS does pertains to confiscation proceedings.
It does indeed. Without trying to advertise what we do, in essence, for the company, we try and help firms who do not have either the expertise or, more importantly, perhaps the time to devote to POCA that it needs. A complicated POCA needs a lot of time spending upon it to justify both your liabilities for the client as well as upholding your proper standards.
Now, I suspect that when we're talking through the practicalities of this, we're going to probably refer to things like fraud cases and drugs cases and so on, just so people have a context of what we're talking about here. Let's take a drug case. So the sort of case where POCA might be engaged or confiscation proceedings might be engaged might be, for example, a cannabis farm, cannabis cultivation, which is uncovered by police, and somebody's then prosecuted for that cultivation. The evidence in that matter may lead people to suggest that there is a significant criminal empire that's been in existence for a while before it, or it may be the case that it's an operation in its infancy. Either way, depending on the view taken by those who prosecute, and of course by the court, investigations will then be undertaken by the Financial Investigations Unit. So that would be a typical scenario for a drugs case.
It would, if you're talking just about cannabis farms.
Yeah.
The major determining factor of the criminal benefit in there is trying to establish how long it's been going and the yield that comes from it.
All right, we'll go into the specifics of these in a moment. So that's perhaps we'll use that as, when we refer to a drugs case, we'll perhaps use that as the textbook drugs case. Importation cases, again relating to drugs, but this is where drugs have been found that have been shipped in from overseas, and again there are different considerations applied to those. We'll call those importation cases. You've then got, I think let's broadly call it fraud cases. So this would be conspiracies to commit fraud of various different sorts. I mean, I'm not going to start giving a lecture on carousel fraud and so on, but let's simply put it this way. A fraud of some sort involving multiple conspirators and a significant amount of money. Let's just leave it at that. I think that's probably all we need to know for these purposes. Yeah. That covers your major POCA groups, if you like. Now, POCA is split up into a number of stages, the first of which really is what we call the benefit figure, or the benefits figure stage. In short, Terry, what do we mean when we say that?
Well, benefit is, the first stage is actually, once following conviction, we're required to actually submit to the court what our assets are, which is, I shan't go into two details, but it's quite important to get that as right as we can to start with, because if we don't do that properly, we could look at hidden assets or potential other problems arising from the court.
There's a sort of fundamental issue, isn't there? If you don't make that declaration thoroughly, and the financial investigator, the FIU, come along and say, well, you've told us about bank accounts 1, 2 and 3, but you've not told us about number 4, or the property that you have that's was bought in auction 4 years ago that's worth nothing now. If you've not declared those, then it would appear, at least on face of it, that you may be being dishonest.
Yes, and that sets the, although you've been convicted and the judge will regard you as a criminal, I've no doubt, it sets the tenor for what the thought processes could bound to follow. But having done that, once you've submitted that, the FIU come up with their statement of information, section 16.3 statement, in which they will look at, give you two benefits. One, the criminal benefit from the actual crime, and then the other benefit that is thought to be criminal, not actually emanating from that crime. And this is where the draconian side, well, if wanted to use that, comes in.
Can you explain what that means for anybody who's not a lawyer? Can you just explain what you mean? So you've obviously got the benefit from the crime. What do you mean by the other benefit, the subsidiary benefit?
What I mean by that is that the FIU will look at your income, and quite simply, if you've got an income that's coming in and you're self-employed and you haven't declared it, that income then automatically now becomes illegal, mm-hmm. because you've not declared it for tax purposes. So that's one side of it. And the other side, they will look at your or the whole income, what you've, however it comes in. And if you can't explain that, well, they don't have to ask you to explain it immediately. They'll just tell you, if they can't see where it's come from, it's an unexplained credit to yourself, and that is automatic criminal benefit unless you can convince the court that it's a legitimate acquisition.
And that's why we say it's draconian, because it's not a matter of them trying to prove it. It's you that has to prove that the money is legitimate.
Oh, yeah. That's right. I mean, yeah. Just a simple example. I'm dealing with one case at the moment on a £2,000 value of steroids.
Right.
And that's all it is. £2,000, it was the value of the steroids the man had. Convicted, became a lifestyle offence, and they now want £635,000 from him.
Yes.
Yeah, and this is something that's fairly common in pocket cases, that you start with a known valuation, whether there's issue taken with it or not, you start with the known valuation of the drugs or the fraud or whatever it may be, and one of the first things as a lawyer you have to do is warn your defendant that the way in which a benefit figure is calculated may mean that whereas he thinks he's dealing with maybe £100,000, the benefit figure may well be calculated to be something like, and it happens fairly frequently, £1 million or more.
Yes.
And of course, when confronted with that, it's called a benefit figure, and a defendant who isn't properly advised at that stage will be wondering, hang on a minute, are you saying that I've benefited from £1 million?
Yes.
Pounds?
And it goes back, of course, as well. It's not just what you've got now.
No, it's transactions over a certain,
yes.
period.
6 years from the date.
Yes.
So this is part of what they refer to as the assumptions, the statutory assumptions. Those assumptions, we don't need to go through all of them, because if you're a practitioner, you'll know about them to some extent. But in short, there are certain rules that apply that the prosecution will set out in their in their statement, saying, right, well, we say that because of this type of case, these are things that the court is entitled to assume about you. And one of them is, for example, that if income has come in over whatever period of time, that it is money improperly obtained.
Yes, and it is for incumbent on ourselves to disprove that or accept it.
Hmm. Now, that's not the only problem, because, of course, when a benefit figure is calculated, it is calculated, for example, probably the best example is a drugs case. It is calculated on the basis of information that the police hold out to be fact regarding, for example, drug valuations. The risk is that people will flatly accept, for example, in importation cases, wholesale values of drugs that are put forward by the prosecution. In cultivation cases, they will accept things like yields of crops, the average yield being whatever, and they'll accept values of the amounts that yield could ultimately produce. People may be making a mistake there, Terry.
Oh, that's absolutely right. It really is important to satisfy yourself from the evidence that the period of time that you're talking about, certainly in cultivation, does exist, mm-hmm. and it's gone through that. The yield is standard, according to the police.
The yield is never right.
No, it's
I don't
never
think I've
right.
ever done a drugs case where the yield is
the
right.
The yield is standard. Yes. They have a formula and say, oh, this is what the
well,
yield
well, it doesn't, and it doesn't actually even accord with their own testing.
Well, no, Kirsten, this is true, isn't
ridiculous.
It? Yeah, the without, again, practitioners will encounter this, but for the sake of interest, it currently appears to be the case that the quoted average yield for a cannabis cultivation is, and I don't have the figures immediately to hand, is it 40 grams per plant or something, isn't it? Whereas in actual fact,
it's a lot lower than that.
The most recent information that the scientists have regarding the average yield places it, I think from recollection, at closer to 18.
Yes,
grams.
I think actually the police's own testing puts it in at something like 28. So that even their own testing,
I said 28.
The government's actual testing is lower than the amount that they use. So it does feel rather. Well, I think dishonest, actually, that they say this is what the yield is, but actually their own tests show it's lower than that. And certainly if you get a good expert, he will go through the other tests that that have been done independently and will say, no, actually, it's nearer 19. So,
all right, so well, that deals some sort of assumptions. There are also some other issues. I mean, it's not a profit cost size when calculating these figures, and people do say, well, hang on a minute, it cost me this much to set up my cannabis farm. The problem is that's a double-edged sword, because the money you paid to buy your equipment...
Where did that come from?
...is potentially, well, it almost always is part of your benefit figure. It's effectively, it's adding and adding and adding. Why is it important, though, Terry, to hesitate at this point of the benefit figure calculation rather than simply looking at what's available? A lot of people do skip over benefit figure, certainly traditionally. Why is that a mistake?
It's a mistake in two ways. I mean, the most extreme example would be to accept a benefit figure that is not right, and then at some stage in the future win the pools, win the lottery.
Oh, are we showing his age? Winning the pools.
Yeah, win the pools. Yeah. Win the lottery. And then be liable to forfeit that. Well, I mean, that's an extreme example. But
I was about to say, first of all, it has happened. And secondly, it's a reality for this reason. That we have a lot of non-lawyer listeners. So just to explain, a confiscation order is what's sometimes referred to as a forever order. That means that however your order is ultimately settled at the determination and enforcement stages, if at some point in the future you do have a pools win, a lottery win, whatever else it may be, then under a system that's usually known as Operation Freshwater, I think that's nationally called that now, an eye is kept on what resources people have. And if they suddenly find that you've acquired a large amount of money, that the benefit figure in your case was, let's say, £1 million, but the realisable amount in your case, your order amount, was £20,000, then bad news, folks, they will come back and take the rest of it. Mm. So if your benefit figure has just been nodded through, if you like, and it's not been properly cut down to the size it ought to be, if you had that pools win in that scenario, and somebody had done their job properly, it would have been £60,000 benefit figure. Then
you're going to be a little bit angry.
Yeah, you lose £40,000 and you can live with it. If it was £1 million and your lottery win amounted to £1 million, the whole lot's gone. So it is important.
Mm. Yeah, it's important to follow on through enforcement proceedings as well, because until you actually paid it off, the order, you're still liable. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, even in civil proceedings on enforcement, you may still get further imprisonment.
You absolutely can, yeah.
And so it is very important to get the benefit figure correct.
So now, the benefit figure calculation, then, that's really a matter, to some extent, between, I suppose, between the professionals, because the FIU will have their methods of calculation. The prosecution will have, I say the prosecution because various prosecuting agencies could be involved here, they will have certain experts that they get reports from, valuation reports, market reports for black market products, such as drugs and so on. And you, as a defence practitioner, will also have places that you will go to get admissible information to go before a court to counter it. What's the role in that situation, just talking about the benefit figure for the moment, what's the role really of the offender?
Well, it'd be nice if offenders were truthful, but you can't always rely on that as the benchmark to look at.
Often including those, convicted of fraud.
As you say, so they need to be open and honest. That's not ideal, is it? No.
No. But it is a if you can actually know where you're going, it is a good starting point. To know where you are, and I always try and talk to people in this way. Let me know what the starting point is, and then we can carry on from there. But to get it right, you really need to know who your experts are and choose the right experts for the benefit figure. If we're looking at drugs, you choose your expert that actually knows what he's talking about. A lot of the experts that are available will get their responses from statistics which are just nationally held on a database which they can go in and look at. There is nothing that can beat a practitioner in the field who has it. I'll give you an example. Recently I needed the wholesale price of cannabis in Holland.
Yes.
Now you can't find that anywhere.
Oddly, it's not a figure that's published in annual financial reports generally.
No. And we eventually found an ex-undercover police officer who had worked in Holland who was able to provide us properly with an expert witness statement.
And did that make a difference in terms of benefit figure?
Potentially. I mean, this case hasn't been decided yet, but it potentially makes a big, big difference in benefit figures.
Why is it you think that the figures that are traditionally relied upon, the national database figures and so on, why is it that they are so frequently inaccurate, do you think?
I think that, well, the laboratory produced. Mm. We have academics that will look at this in a sterile environment. Mm. It doesn't cater for the actualities of the drugs world. It doesn't cater for people not paying. Mm. Doesn't pay for people being ripped off.
Yeah, because bad debt is something of a problem in the drug world,
indeed,
as it is in the fraud world, of course, as well.
And prices can fluctuate so wildly. Mm-hmm. With if you know who you're dealing with, if you're a regular, proper payer, that your actual benefit can differ from somebody who's got a reputation for not doing that.
And likewise, with matters where you're talking about, we'll talk about importation cases, where you're talking about very large quantities in importation, as with in most other fields of life, there are discounts to be had for buying in bulk.
Very much so. Mm. Very much so. On the case I've talked about with Holland, I mean, although we did it for hidden assets more than the criminal value, we got the price down from something like 19 million to less than £30,000.
Yeah. And that is
a big difference.
Yeah, and you may sort of think, well, this is all a very interesting academic exercise, but put yourself in the position of the offender, quite often a prisoner at this stage, who's dealing with that, and you think, well, how much sympathy do I have for them? Well, I don't imagine that anybody realistically in especially sort of moderate drug cases rather than sort of, massive ones.
I mean, nobody has any sympathy for the guys at the top of the chain.
No, quite. But very rarely. I mean, as the truth of university acknowledge, it's never the guy at the top of the chain who's in court. No. But in those situations, it isn't right, it wouldn't be right for somebody to be responsible financially to the tune of an absurd amount of money and therefore the prison sentence in default of payment that comes with it. So if we're to have faith in the justice system, as we say often on this show, then we have to have faith that it's being done properly.
Mm. We've also got that point about it being a forever order.
Yeah.
So the whole point of prison is you're supposed to have been rehabilitated by going to prison. That is your punishment. If you come out and that's still hanging over your head and you think, oh, I made 30,000 out of this, not 19 million.
Yeah.
That's a big thing to have hanging over your head.
All right, well, let's imagine then that we've got the benefit figure right. It may be that we need to have a disputed hearing on the point of the benefit figure. It may be that it's able to be resolved. But at least we have the tools to do that. Counsel isn't going in, solicitors aren't going in, armed with, I was saying last week on the show, what we reckon. They're going in with sustainable arguments and expert evidence to support it. All right, so to some extent, that may be half of the battle, but what comes next is looking at what this person realistically has.
Yes, once the benefit's established, we then come to realisable assets, which can be quite problematic.
I think this might be where spouses comes in.
Spouses and houses.
Absolutely.
it becomes quite problematic. We talk about houses to start with. Houses, quite simply, the typical valuation we get on a house from the FIU is from Zoopla.
That's Zoopla, listeners. It's a bit like Rightmove. It's a bit more involved than that. It does show market trends and so on. But on occasion, I looked up our area recently. Oh my word! It's quite often very wrong.
Yeah. So we get that. Now that gives a valuation which I've never yet had agreed.
No.
By a client.
No.
And there again, we go back to expert witnesses. It is essential to get an expert witness who can stand up in court, who is qualified to say, well, they're not just an estate agent.
That's a value.
That's a very valid point, because it's not just a matter of having an estate agent. Zoopla was, I think, chosen probably because it looks at a wider field of statistics. It looks not just at house prices, you know, recent sales or whatever. It also looks at regional trends. It looks at trends in terms of regional investment, for example. It also has a confidence score for the area in question, which, by all means, go onto the website and look how it's calculated. But the confidence score is, it becomes relevant when you get to enforcement stages, perhaps later on. But you're dealing with a lot of raw information that's processed in a very simple manner, which perhaps doesn't tell the full story.
It's interesting as well, I think, because in civil hearings, there's quite a lot of hearings, ancillary relief springs to mind, where actually estate agents' evaluations are spot on. That's exactly what you want. You know, to get three or four of those, and it's worked out sort of down the middle. Now, that's not a bad place to start, I guess, for a POCA case, but that's assuming that you can pass that over to the FIU, and they say, yes, that's fine, we'll accept that. Once you get beyond that, we're into the realms of not accepting hearsay evidence.
Well, you are, and also, Terry, I'm sort of thinking about the current state of markets and so on, the property market. There is a difficulty right now. There was a time, as Kirsten says, when simple valuations from estate agents, 9 times out of 10, would do the job. These days it's a little more tricky, isn't it, because the market isn't that simple anymore.
No, it's a lot more tricky. What you get now is that we get a valuation, and come 3 months down the line, when they, if that's agreed at court, you've not sold the house, where do you go? And then you've got to start looking, going back to court again for variations, saying, well, what can we do, where can we go?
Lots of public money involved, of course, in all of this as well.
Whereas if you can get an agreed basis to start with for that as well. But what is also important is trying to get the Crown to agree that reasonable selling costs should be deducted from that selling price.
Now, there is an authority, quite clear authority, for that, but it's not that simple again, because the Crown are reluctant in a lot of cases to agree anything. Give us a sort of example of what you mean by trying to get the price to be a realistic amount.
Yeah. I've recently dealt with a case where a house is valued at £195,000. My client's equity in that is £5,000 a mortgage off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If he was to sell the house for £195,000, his selling costs will be greater
than £5,000.
Then it's £5,000. Once he's done estate agents and solicitors' fees, will be greater than that. So he's going to be selling for negative equity.
Now that presents a significant problem, doesn't it? And in actual fact, in that scenario, absolutely nobody wins.
Nobody wins, and what was galling about that case is that the Crown would not agree.
Yeah.
To any figure. Mm. In fact, only needed to put 4% to it for it being negative equity on selling costs, and they wouldn't agree. So we know that in 6 months' time, we already know we're going back. Mm. Court, unless somebody comes up and gives us the asking price, which is good.
But that's the thing, the state there hasn't recovered any money.
No.
The individual has, and maybe that, I don't know the situation there, but it may be that they have family resident in that house or something else. It may simply be that you've got somebody who's now rendered homeless, you've got you've got no gain at all to the state, and you've got public funds used both to prosecute and defend an entirely fruitless transaction,
probably to fund the housing of the other members of the family as well with the housing benefit.
Maybe there is that, and then of course the money also spent on then going back to fix what should never have gone wrong in the first place.
It'd be much simpler if the Crown could just put a charge on your property.
Well, quite, of course it would, and they could recover it when the market picks up. Yeah, absolutely. But that's not the way it works. So how do you deal with that scenario in terms of documents that you can put before a court to say, right, this is the problem? So even if the Crown are sticking their fingers in their ears and saying, right, we're not going to play ball with you at all, what documents in that situation would you advise putting before a Crown court?
What, are you talking about the variation stage or at the time of the order?
Yeah, the time of the order, the getting it right stage.
The getting it right stage, you've really got to have a draft contract from the estate agent saying, this is what I will charge.
Yeah.
So you will know where you're going at a minimum. You need the same from the estate agency. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the minimum you need. You need to look at what it would cost you from the mortgage company, because we're in a mortgage, to actually redeem the mortgage.
Yes.
But if there are extra costs on that,
yep,
that come through.
Especially if it's a recently purchased property as well, of course, in terms of redemption penalties, which, of course, may well exist. Because in that situation, you could end up also with a house that isn't technically in negative equity at the time of making an order, but by process of all of those factors stuck together, not only is there no money to be taken out of the property by the state, but actually in some cases, you could have an offender who, as a result of being forced to sell a property for no considerable purpose, ends up with an additional debt, I would imagine at least up to about £5,000, I would imagine.
Yeah. And when, theoretically, the state has taken everything he has.
Yeah. And no way of then repaying the debt that exists, yeah.
And that then just takes us a little bit round in, not a convoluted way, to the title you put on, we put on this.
Spouses and houses.
Where do you go with the wife? It's not my role, I say.
Yeah.
But, you know, the advice is that they must take into consideration the wife's position. She must get independent advice.
Mm-hmm.
And at the right time, that needs to be put forward as a third party application. Normally, I think, at enforcement stage.
Well, that's right, yeah.
But really, it ought to be the consideration at the time of determination of the order.
Yeah. We're back to public funds, aren't we?
I mean, in practice, it's very rare that you'll find a case where the first time that third party interests are considered as enforcement. The statute does allow for that. In fact, on one reading or two, it almost seems to encourage it. But of course, yeah, I call it the getting it right stage. It's probably best dealt with fairly early doors at the point of dealing with realisable assets. All right, well, properties are, you know, notwithstanding the various market issues and so on, properties are potentially fairly straightforward. What about issues such as other types of assets, rather less...
less straightforward, yeah. Motor vehicles.
Motor vehicles is what I was kind of getting to, yeah.
Yeah, by far less straightforward.
What's the problem with them?
Again, we get valuations off internet sites, which are, I think, more wildly inaccurate than the house price indications on there. And there seems to be no common sense applied to these.
Well, there never is when anybody comes to sell their house, their car. It's their pride and joy.
Well, there's no common sense. There is no consideration taken of the mileage of the vehicle, the state of the vehicle. Actually, it's just an average.
Yes.
We'll go for this.
And even with the online tools that that will factor some of that in, for example, there are two tools traditionally used. One is the Auto Trader vehicle valuer, and the other one is Glasses, which is the one preferred by the car industry.
Yes, makes sense.
But again, as you say, they don't cover every scenario. They don't really give much consideration to the state of the vehicle that you are talking about. They also, as odd as it sounds, don't consider simple matters like the resale value of a particular colour of a car, which is peculiar because actually in the motor industry, that is something that is very heavily borne into consideration. For example, when I last bought a car, I very much wanted it in British Racing Green. I was told two things about it. One is I shouldn't have a car in British Racing Green because I wasn't over 50, which I thought was rather rude. And two, that the resale value of a British Racing Green version of the car that I bought was considerably less after 5 years than the value of, as I eventually purchased, a blue car.
Hmm.
Now, I mean, that sounds daft, but if you think about it,
not.
That, especially if there's more than one vehicle, that can end up making a big difference.
It's not so daft now. Police forces now are buying silver vehicles and not white.
Yep.
Because of the resale value.
Yes.
Yep.
At the end of the life there is greater.
Yep.
So it's not daft. Well, the way that I suggest people do this is to get a proper professional valuation of the particular vehicle.
Who do you go to for that? So let's take that scenario. Let's say I was my car outside. I want to go and get that valued. Where do I go to get a proper value for that?
Certified vehicle engineer, one who is qualified, has a qualification, does inspections, does the sort of man who would do a report for the AA.
Yeah.
Suitably qualified. It's all there. You can find the website. They would do a valuation of a vehicle relatively cheaply.
Well, I was going to say, how much and who pays?
If you get the right valuer, You can get it done for under £100 with a full valuation, an update just before court.
Yes.
On any variation.
That's very good value.
Now, the thing is, people talk about public money, and judges sometimes say, oh, I'm not adjourning this for a report of this, it's going to cost far too much money. The reality is that actually, if you know your experts and you know the right people, first of all, as you say, it can be done at the right price. And when we are talking about public money there, again, you've got to consider that the public money spent in getting this right ultimately saves considerable money, potentially, in fixing it when it is wrong.
Yeah, that is the major problem. The major problem is going for a valuation you're not going to get for the vehicle.
Yeah.
And then you have to end up asking the Crown, can I sell this vehicle for £1,000 less than we've agreed? And are you happy for a variation?
Mm.
On the order that way.
And whilst the situation is now more efficient than it used to be, there used to be a system whereby you'd have to get, and I'm sure you've probably heard of these listeners, certificates of inadequacy, which involved an application to the High Court and then coming back to the Crown Court and so on. Although it's now Crown Court one-stop shop, it's still considerable money and resources at the public expense, sometimes for... and the most appalling one I remember, and it was still under the certificate of inadequacy rule, so it's going back a few years, was having to, because the prosecution would not back down over the sum of, now wait for it, it's a very, very large amount, £365. I'm not even joking, sadly. As Theresa May would say, I'm not even making this up, differences, I'm not.
She wasn't there.
Yes, the situation was that they wouldn't back down on it. We had to go to the High Court to deal with this application, who then sent it back to the Crown Court. Unfortunately, when it eventually found its way into the hands of a High Court judge,
well, just raised an eyebrow and went ballistic, really.
Yeah, the response received was, yes, I think this needs to be done. And it was done in fairly short measure. But the public money wasted to do that was extraordinary. I did at one point try and figure it out. It was in excess of £4,000, I remember that. And again, £4,000, not a huge amount, and a lot of times these cost a lot more than that. That was only the defence costs, and that was largely
11 times the figure we're arguing about.
Precisely, and that's the point, isn't it? All right, so what have we got? We've got a benefit figure. We know about our properties, as in bricks and mortar. Cars, we know about getting them valued and so on. What else springs to mind, Terry, in terms of what needs to be looked into?
What about businesses in other people's names?
That's an interesting question.
Businesses in other people's names, that's made me think now. it's right that at the start, when you do your Section 18, which is your statement of means, that you've actually done a director's search. You need to get that established and done. Maybe don't get caught. Like I said, it'd be nice if you could trust the people you talk to. So you need to get that done. But that could encompass, if you were not totally right, family members.
Well, since this is massively where spouses often figure, isn't it? Where you have, you know, businesses that have been placed in traditionally the wife's name. We are dealing with this as though women never get caught out by POCA, aren't we? But traditionally, you know, she's been running a business, but it's entirely down to tainted money, tainted gifts.
So yes, what of tainted gifts?
What of tainted gifts? Tainted gifts are causing more and more problems these days. As I was talking earlier off air here about a case just at this minute, where a mortgage has been legitimately obtained on a property and paid off. We now have a property that is mortgage free, properly owned by somebody with an order. He takes out a second mortgage on the property just to raise some capital. I know where the capital's spent. By the by, the prosecution or the Crown have not included that ongoing. That's included in unexplained assets. But because part of his business, all his money from his business, including the fraud money, went into the same pot, we're now saying that the mortgage repayments are tainted. I know it's not a tainted gift in that sense,
but
it's all the same thing. We're now saying the mortgage is tainted, and the Crown are trying to assert that the whole property,
which has got to be wrong.
it's there, but that's the assertion that we have to battle.
Yes.
They're now saying that the whole property is, it comes within the criminal benefit figure. So that's one side of the tainted gifts. The other side is that what happens when you give somebody a car? You give your wife a car out of the money you've got. Is that a tainted gift? The answer is simply yes.
Indeed.
Under that, it is simply yes. But where do you go to do that? How do you recover that asset? Let's say that you've now separated. Let's say you gave it to the lady down the road and you now don't see on a Wednesday afternoon.
I don't know what you're implying.
How do you get that back? And it's very difficult.
Very difficult.
You know, under the Act to do it, but it is still included in your benefit figure and in your realisable assets.
It is, and to be dealt with at a later stage, which we'll come to in just a moment, the enforcement stage.
Yeah.
All right, now this is the big one, I suppose. This is the one, let's create a nightmare scenario. Let's say we've got a drugs importation case, because they're always a good example of these, and you have a benefit figure of, let's go crazy, let's have £2 million, why not? Even after we've had our experts and everything else, we're still looking at £2 million. Don't worry, it started at 10. We've got identified realisable assets of about, I don't know, let's be generous, shall we? Should we say £250,000 in properties and vehicles? Now, the Crown is saying, you've had rather more than that, and we don't know where it is. They invite the court to make a finding of hidden assets. This is the big draconian part.
So you, in your scenario there, you've got £1.75 million.
Oh yes.
Hidden assets, and the court is putting the onus upon you to say, no, I haven't.
Hmm.
Well, that's a nightmare.
And by the way, we're also still in prison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So
just to add to the fun of this.
So if you need any paperwork to show where all this money went to and where it came from, you're in prison.
So, where do we start, Terry?
So, where do we go? How do you prove a negative? Well, it is the major problem. The easy scenario is if the man hasn't had it and is up to his ears in debt.
Yeah.
You need to show what your credit card history is, what your repayment history is on the banks.
But
the fact you've never been abroad.
Yes, I was about to say, that on its own won't do, not least of which, because of course there's now some authority in this jurisdiction, and in at least two more than I can think of, to say that it is quite often the hallmark of a sophisticated criminal to create an image of debt around them when they think there may be a risk that they may be getting to the point where they might be being caught. So whilst that may have served as adequate at one point, it probably won't anymore. What else do you have to? What else can you use to corroborate your position?
Well, don't forget with that, you need to go back over the whole period. You don't just say, because if he thought he might get caught now,
yes.
We do it. You really have to go back. And it does help in those situations to go back beyond your 6-year period.
Yes.
And show that there has been no change in lifestyle.
Yeah.
Yes.
At all with that. Where else to go from that? You can look at the benefit situations, if we got any benefits coming in that should have been means tested. I know we're hiding money.
Mm.
We go there. But once you get past that, it really is a question of what can we check? Can we check the land registry? Crown should have done that.
But the Crown will usually have done that over a relatively short period of time, not much beyond the 6 years that they're inclined to look.
So we need to look and say, is there any land? It's a negative positive if we can actually say there have been no land registry transactions.
So what would be your checklist?
So if you're proving a negative with a negative, we've checked where we might find positives and there aren't any.
Well, so here's some positives. Let's start a checklist. I mean, scribble this down if you ever struggle with this as a practitioner, but let's start with it. So first of all, the existence of debt, long-term debt. Sorry, that's somebody throwing something downstairs outside. You've then got the history of no ownership of land, or at least no ownership of land beyond what the Crown knows about in the course of these proceedings. Again, look further back than 6 years. You then talked about passports.
Passports. Problem with the common market now, of course, is there are no passport stamps.
Mm-hmm.
But at least let's get the passport out and say there is no indication here that we've been abroad.
Yeah, outside of of the EU, certainly. Yeah.
Well, and again, your credit cards are going to help with that, because if you if you're going anywhere on a plane these days, you tend to do it by credit card.
Yeah. So there's a lot of things you can do that actually proves the negative within this, and you need to be as imaginative as you can.
I was going to say that it's about sort of in that phrase, thinking outside the box, isn't it? And
it is. You look at the house, the carpet. You can go into a house and. When did you last have your carpet?
Mm. Well, you and I had a case some years ago now, Terry, where I remember we had photographs of the Crown was suggesting that there was a glorious property overseas in the Eastern Bloc that was the proceeds of big drugs operation, and how terribly exciting it was too. We had photographs in the end of that, didn't we?
We did. It was little more than a tin shack.
It was a tin shack with a very sad-looking woman stood outside of it. I don't know. I still don't know why she was looking quite so sad. She wasn't the one in prison, but yeah,
she might have had to live in the shack.
That could probably be the reason, actually. Right, yeah. And it didn't help that the photos were in the snow, but there it was. But those photographs again create a picture. It wasn't the mansion that perhaps on the face of the papers it sounded like it could have been.
And that all helps.
It absolutely helps, yeah. What about statements from family members regarding someone's financial history?
It's better, I think, that family members are not always the best people.
Sure. But where you've got a parent, for example, who's... Let's talk about a cultivation case. It's a fairly common scenario that Johnny has been with his mates running a cannabis factory down at someone's lockup. And Mum knows nothing about it until, of course, the police come and collar him, and then she realises, oh, it's not a horrible mistake, oh, God, it's actually true. And then she says, well, hang on a minute, they say this benefit figure's £1 million. Well, if it's £1 million, if he's had £1 million, why is he borrowing money from me every week? Mm-hmm. In those sort of cases, again, it's part of the picture, isn't it?
It's all part of the picture, if you can do that, if you can look at that. There are... things you can do. If you've got a man that likes horse racing, and you live in a small little town, you could look at and go to the bookmakers who will know him, and look at his, if they will give it you, look at his spending history. Mm-hmm. You can certainly go to casinos.
Do you know what this is reminding me of? It's just reminding me of proper policing. Do you remember that?
Well, that's because Terry's DCI from the days when they used to do it.
Since 1995. Yeah.
you can even go to casinos.
Yep.
This man's a member, because they know exactly how much you've spent. Mm. And say, look, he's never spent more than £200 a year in the 10 years he's been a member.
Absolutely. I mean, people refer to lifestyle offences, and that's part of the issue about benefit figures and so on. But actually, the question of lifestyle is damned important, because precisely that you say, how do you prove a negative? How do I prove I've not got any money? The answer is you prove the things that demonstrate that you are somebody with no money. And that does involve some creative thinking, and you do have to get to know the offender that you're dealing with. I say offender here because they've already been convicted before we start getting emails.
There are a number of scenarios you can think of. You may want to show that you do your weekly shopping at the cheapest place.
Yeah. Yes.
You can do it rather than going to one of the top class places, the more expensive supermarkets than down at the bottom.
Mm. Yeah, that's why I shop in Aldi rather than M&S, you see.
Yeah,
that's not true.
Shush. Yes.
That's a positive point. Yeah. Another positive negative. But you have to really sit down and think. And it's where I was saying earlier on, you need the time when you're doing these cases to be able to spend at it. Mm. And it all depends on your client. And once you know your client, you can then work round all these answers. If you don't know your client, it becomes more and more difficult.
It does. It's a shame, actually, that our spectator here isn't partaking, because actually I can think of a case that she and I were involved in not so long ago where she came to know far, far more about this gentleman, his family, his mates, and...
His mother in particular.
His mother in particular. Welcome to the show, by the way. You're remaining anonymous because you don't have the clearance of your partner to be here, your senior partner.
Precisely.
Very well. We'll disguise your voice later. We won't. In that case, though, it was important for you to have that contact with the rather squeaky clean family. They weren't involved in his enterprises at all, because they could demonstrate in his case that he really wasn't living the lifestyle that benefit figure in his case suggested.
Yeah, exactly. We got to know them pretty well. We got statements from them, didn't we? Mm-hmm. That was really helpful, wasn't it, when it came?
Slightly further in the family as well, I think, from recollection, was it granddad?
Yeah, him. He'd been paying them rent. It was really helpful in bringing down our benefit figure.
So the positive negatives, as you call them, Terry. All right, now, we know what we're arguing about. We know how to narrow down the issues. We know how to put together evidence that dispels the impression that might be created. All looking good so far. The order is then made. Now, that's quite an important point, and I'll tell you what, we're not going to cover that on this show, simply because it is hoped at some point in the future, in the other life, when we're not in podcast towers, Kirsten and I, as you know, are members
when
of...
When does that happen?
Very rarely. We're members of a chambers in Manchester, Central Chambers.
Will we see the sunlight again?
Maybe. It's hoped that we will at some point, possibly with Mr. Fox here, be running a CPD seminar on the subject of what happens in terms of the practicalities, if you like, hearing day of the order and forwards. We won't cover that in any great detail now, simply because of the time that we've got, and we've got a couple of things we do need to cover quickly before we finish the show. But long story short is, Terry, and your business exists because solicitors firms, even the big firms, to be quite frank, in fact, sometimes more so with the big firms, don't always have the man hours to throw at doing these jobs as thoroughly as they ought to be done. That must be common ground, because I think anyone who's ever worked in this area of practice knows that that is the case. All right, what are the advantages to a solicitor's firm of employing? So in other words, I mean, we talk about, you know, revenue capture, solicitor's firms trying to keep that money in-house. What are the advantages of solicitor's firms saying, actually, hang on a moment, we're going to send this Pocker case, now it's gone to confiscation, out to people like LRS?
There are many, many, many.
This is your advertising feature
I
moment.
I in slot forever. No, quite simply, by sending it out, you don't lose control of a case. You retain the client. The client is yours, keeps coming back to you. Mm-hmm. It's not, doesn't become property of anybody else if there is property in a client. First of all, no employment issues, no holidays. No sickness to worry about.
So you have a contract with a firm that is good for the duration of your involvement in that case, which is ordinarily until the end of that case.
Yeah, just that particular case. And the contract simply is, if they don't like what you're doing, you're pulled off it.
When you talk about the clients themselves and sort of property in the client, I mean, increasingly these days, because of diversions from the criminal justice system and all sorts of other things, you may be tempted to think there is property in a client. In reality, the property in a client is that if a client is satisfied with the service they receive from their representatives, a combination of solicitors, external caseworkers, and counsel, then they will stay with you. If they are not, they will vote with their feet.
Not only will they stay, they will bring on.
Yes, because some of them are villains who have associates, you see. It's very true.
Surely not. Yeah.
Now, in those situations, then, solicitors are missing out on revenue capture in the immediate case that they've got, or are they? Because you're obviously doing a lot more work in that. Is all that money going to the agent, or does it go to solicitors' firms?
Well, at this time, and I don't suspect we'll change before this programme goes out.
You've got till Friday.
You've got till Friday. We're being paid for what we do.
Yep.
If it's justified on taxation, we're getting paid for it, so we're not on a fixed fee. So if the work is done properly and conscientiously, there you should actually do more on the file than a firm who are pushed and are only doing the basics, the bare minimum to get by. And so there is perhaps very little difference once you've taken a fee out in the revenue stream.
Sure. In which case, the advantage to the firm financially is what?
To the firm financially is that they do not have to do a thing apart from supervise the whole affair. They do not have to do a thing towards the preparation, presentation of the case.
And that they then retain future business is the hope, isn't it?
And also with various firms, we do not charge, do not expect payment until the payment is received by the solicitor at the end of the case, and then only on what is actually paid and not notionally what the file notes added up to.
So there's no prospect for loss on the part of a solicitor by employing an agent such as LRS, though?
If they get the terms right. I mean, I can wait up to 2 years.
Sure.
As I am told some poor impecunious barristers may have to.
Quite so.
But I can wait 2 years for a fee on a file. Mm-hmm. Because that's how long it would take to go through the whole process.
But that's your concern, and you know that. It's not the solicitor's concern.
No.
Because they're waiting too, I suppose. But yeah.
They're waiting too.
Well, they're waiting, but they're not... It's not dead money to them. So although they're waiting for that, it's not whilst they're doing work. They're getting on with other stuff and getting paid on the other stuff.
Quite.
And that's the big advantage, is that POCA cases are incredibly time-consuming.
Yeah.
And actually, in terms of the hours you spend on them, I doubt even Terry gets paid for the work he actually does.
And actually, there's another point about that, which is we're talking about clients being happy. The reality is as well, I'm afraid this is just one of the facts of life, that somebody accused, even of sometimes very serious offences, they'll have a certain degree of wanting your attention as a as a solicitor, as counsel, as whatever else.
Especially somebody who's got millions of pounds worth of assets and is used to living that sort of lifestyle.
Well,
actually.
Maybe so, but even those who aren't suddenly become, even somebody who's, let's face it, at the end of the day, their own their only assets are a beaten up Astra and a house with sort of 10k's equity left in it. Those people, to those particular individuals, those assets are every bit as important as everything else. They're probably even more important in some cases in their minds than their liberty. Clients at the time of confiscation can become, as can their families, who potentially stand to lose out on money and so on, extremely demanding. When you say that clients are time consuming, Terry, I imagine quite a lot of your job involves not quite hand holding, but quite a lot of client contact in order to maintain that relationship that's so important to producing the evidence that's needed.
Yeah, the more complex the matter is, that's absolutely right, the more time you need. It's not exponential, but it's disproportionate.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
In going up the time you have to spend. And the other advantage, of course, is that I have time to do a proper brief for barristers.
Which, of course, we are always greatly obliged for.
Yes. Especially in pocket cases, it has to be said.
Absolutely. Now, we're governed by no restrictions on account of being a podcast at all about advertising, which is brilliant, because it does mean that, you know, we can keep mentioning Cafe Nero's until they eventually sponsor the show.
The problem is it just me? It is a different cafe every week, isn't it? I'm sure it is.
That's probably the problem, isn't it? No, fair enough. We'll have to pick one and run with it. But it does also mean that those who, solicitors, experts of all sorts of fields, who give up their time to come and talk in your ear holes, we do like to give them an opportunity to say where they are at and how they can be contacted. Teddy, your moment in the spotlight, my friend.
I can tell you Terry's website if you like. It's www.legalreviewservices, that's all one word, .co.uk.
That's all you need?
That's about to say, that's probably all you need, isn't it? Yeah.
It'll be in the show notes.
Will it?
Will it, Kirsten? It'll be in the show notes.
When those show notes eventually appear?
Yes.
Baby brain. Anyway, oh, crikey, not disclosed that on the show up until now, have we? Well, there you go, cat's out of the bag. Seriously, if it were a video show, you'd know anyway. All right, well, let's move on from there. For those who are going to say, oh, what about enforcement? First of all, keep an eye out for seminars on the subject. And secondly, it may be, depending on Terry's availability, we may do an enforcement show at some point in the future, but we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Kirsten, a couple of other stories in the news. Got very little time to talk about any of them, but let's have a very quick look at them.
Let's ask Terry about that. How do you feel about this new defending your home law, Terry?
Murderous charter. Sorry.
We know what you think.
I think it's absolutely an excellent way of setting up a good murder.
Yeah, I think that's
murderous charter. Thank you very much.
I can foresee some people being invited into homes and suddenly found a window broken and a shotgun.
Because it's blooming obvious, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's precisely what one who was so inclined would do. The reason we said at the start of the show this was sort of, you know, the same thing that keeps coming around. In the past, there's been all, I think everyone who's occupied that job has at some point or another said, we are going to rebalance the right of the homeowner against... we're going to set out clarifications, a reaffirming of the law. I've lost track of the different expressions we've had for we're going to leave the law exactly the same and say that we're doing something about it.
Or they're not, which would be even worse. It would be more terrifying, really, actually.
So...
Especially, interestingly, the only person I can think of who didn't, I think... was Ken Clark.
He did, Freud. Sorry.
Did he?
Yes.
I don't remember
sorry.
Him doing it.
His was a restatement of the law, I think.
Yeah, so I don't think he wasn't planning on changing it, saying I'm going to change the law.
No.
He was more for the education side of things, which I have to say is that surely that what they say is that people don't understand what they can and cannot do.
Because the notion of reasonable force is apparently completely alien to all.
Well, they do, and they keep banging on about proportionate force. And proportionate force is not really actually the test. It's whether it's reasonable. It doesn't actually have to be proportionate.
No,
you can use
doesn't.
Disproportionate force if it was reasonable to do so at the time. So a little woman might actually, using a knife to stab somebody, may actually be perfectly reasonable in circumstances where somebody built by, the proverbial... it isn't reasonable to use a knife because he had fists that would do the trick. I mean, it's all a matter of education, surely, that for these people to...
What's worrying about it here, though, is it's not simply a clarification or a restatement.
No.
What the proposal is that disproportionate force may be used, except where it is grossly disproportionate.
Because that's so much easier to get your head around, the definition of what grossly disproportionate is, as opposed to what is reasonable.
Yeah.
It's just so much clearer, isn't it?
I'm just wondering, in this room, has anyone actually got anything positive to say about this?
We're all looking at our silent guest, because she thinks you should be able to kill anybody who steps over your threshold.
Absolutely, yes. Come the change in the law, heads will roll, I would imagine. Madam X, as I'm now going to call you.
Oh, I'm glad people don't know my name as I'm saying this.
Yeah, me too.
But yes, I think, you know, they cross that barrier into your home and some people don't understand what it means by reasonable. I think at the time that doesn't really go through your mind. Oh, is this reasonable? So I think what they're trying to do is to, you know, give a little bit more elastic to the law and allow people to do that bit more. I think it's great. Mm.
It'll just move from there and then go into your property.
Yes.
Mm. Not your home.
Well, actually, yeah, sorry, Terry.
Already
according
there.
According to this, it's effectively an extension to self-defence. More generally, it's not just in the context of burglary. This is defence of yourself, another, or in some circumstances, property. This is intended to be broad, I think. That could throw into disarray... I would imagine pretty much. Well, actually, I'll tell you what.
I still don't see how it's changing, though.
Well, it's not.
Well, that's the point.
When they
isn't
say grossly
it? Because
disproportionate, the answer is you mean unreasonable.
Well, it is, because the whole thing is, yes, in the heat of battle, so to speak, if somebody's attacking you or whatever, you don't have time to think about that. But it's a phrase that is used again and again and again in the courtroom. You do not have the time to weigh up the niceties.
Mm.
That is taken into account with what the law on self-defence is. It's accepted that, you know, if you're standing in a kitchen and some burglar comes through your door and you're terrified out of your wits and you picked up a knife and stabbed him, even several times, that's probably quite reasonable.
Yeah.
It's all a matter for a jury to decide, is it
reasonable?
And
juries generally have common sense.
Yes.
It's interesting as well, everyone keeps mentioning, I forget the fella's name, is it Tony Martin?
Tony Martin.
Tony Martin, the Norfolk
farmer. The man who shot somebody in the back as they were running away.
With the 1300, who was convicted of murder. Later on appeal, it was found to be manslaughter by reason of the fact that he had a sociological disorder that was specifically targeted towards burglars who came to his house.
In his face, he'd been burgled six times.
Yeah,
but he was waiting up for them.
That was certainly the Crown's case. He was waiting up with a gun. It wasn't fired from halfway downstairs, as he said. It was fired from the doorway of a downstairs.
And they were out of
door.
The property by then.
And they were out of the door, and he decided to give them both and barrels,
the
as it were.
The other one, I have to say, I don't know a lot about this.
Just jumping off on that one.
Yeah.
In his case, just in case you're wondering, Mr. Grayling, even on your current construction of that, he still would be guilty of manslaughter.
Presumably.
Well, we think.
I don't know whether he would.
Yeah.
The other one is that's quoted. This is at the BBC. Is the 2008 case, which Munir Hussain was jailed. He got 30 months. So I'm guessing not murder again.
No.
After chasing and attacking with a cricket bat one of three intruders who tied up his family.
Yeah.
The key word in this is surely chasing. I don't know.
You may think so.
But I'm thinking he possibly wasn't still in his house and he chased him quite a long way before attacking him with the cricket bat. You're outside then defending your home. And actually he didn't die. That's why he was convicted of grievous bodily harm.
He didn't die. Didn't try hard enough, as Chris Grayling, I'm sure, would have it. All right, well...
I just don't see how it's going to make it any clearer.
No, in reality, again, it may just be a slightly cleverer version of the lip service that is paid every year by successive Home Secretaries.
I just wish we could have a Justice Secretary and a Home Secretary who can read the law. I mean, I know Chris Grayling did his defence, he's not actually a lawyer.
Well, no, but it's not the point, is it? They know what the law says. They've been advised thoroughly on the law. And the question they've asked their advisers is, how do we word something that sounds like we're taking the most devastatingly dramatic action in relation to it with, in reality, doing absolutely naff all about it?
Why don't they just spend a little bit of money, less than it would cost to go through the whole thing of changing the law, and put an advertising campaign on the television? Or maybe sponsor an episode of Coronation Street so that... You know, people can follow it and see why that works.
Actually, I laugh about that.
It's actually not a bad idea.
Don't use Hollyoaks, though, because people will just be distracted.
Should we have another rant?
Should we move on to... Right, in case you're wondering if we're getting terribly political, not really. We're being populist and nonsensical about the fact that it's the Tory Party conference and everyone's favourite panto villain, Theresa May.
This isn't political because the last lot wanted to bring in exactly the same thing. So,
yes. That's true.
They started it.
All right, so Theresa May has told the Conservative Party annual conference that she wants victims of antisocial behaviour to be allowed a choice of punishments to those found guilty. She says they'll be given a list of options, a menu, if you will.
Terry's laughing.
Ranging from restorative to punitive. I wonder which end they'll go for the most part. There'll be nobody working, cleaning up... they may want it to be carried out nearby or as far away as possible, because I can't imagine that causing any difficulties he's breached it. Why? Because the victim of this burglary in Manchester said that he wanted him to do street cleaning
in Norfolk.
Yes. Oh, that'll be fine.
We're probably playing devil's advocate just a little bit.
No, I'm sorry. I'm reading from a quoted speech from Theresa May to quote her quoting Nigel Farage. I'm not making this up. This is what she has said.
What, that it's going to be in different counties?
Theresa May says, quote, they might want it to be carried out nearby or as far away as possible. In fact, she doesn't say, and then we'll listen. She says they might want it.
But as far away as possible is probably the other side of the county rather than in Spain.
If you like. She also says, I'm just running
just
out
so
of go
much
power.
Well, maybe the new police commissioners will... set those limits.
Well, it's almost like, oh, you've heard this show before, you know how we segue clumsily. All right, well, actually, yes, she's in the same speech said that she's cutting police forces targets, and budgets, there we go. But crime will not rise. She criticised the previous government, saying they need to cut back on bureaucracy and get back to fighting crime. So we've taken an axe to police red tape. I hope that's metaphorically, otherwise that's an offensive weapon.
Depends whether it's grossly disproportionate or not.
Right. Saving up to 4.5 million police hours a year. Is that police hours, PCSO hours, traffic warden hours? I don't know, but anyway, whatever it is. Getting the equivalent of an extra 2,100 officers back onto the streets.
The equivalent, not actually.
If we had the time, we really don't, I'd let you work your mathematical wonders on that. But in short, yeah, she's saying that none of this is as daft as it sounds, because it's all right. The new police commissioners will make sure this all works perfectly. Terry, police commissioners? Elected police commissioners?
Electedly. I always have thought that having a mayor or a police commissioner is an excellent idea.
Mm.
I think it ought to be totally and utterly devoid from party politics. And until you can make that distinction, I can't see as where we're going to achieve anything.
Well, you can Boris Johnson. There's a man completely devoid of... insert word here. But no, it's a serious point. Yeah, if this wasn't about mayors being political, party political rather, and actually driving improvements in their communities, that would be fine. But unfortunately, that's not the nature of the proposal,
with, have
is it?
Issues with
that's why you're a barrister
well.
And I'm not. You can speak properly.
No, I just interrupt you. Okay. You mean this, don't you? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so in short, though, that's...
That's what I'm getting at. There are no known, that I know of, certainly in the area I live, ex-police officers applying to be commissioners.
There was in London, certainly, rather famously, but outside of London, no, I don't know. There must be one or two somewhere, but not in your area, no.
Not where I know.
You're Midlands-based, aren't you, I think? Yeah.
But who knows about policing?
But I think, isn't that partly the point, that they actually want people who don't come from a policing background, you get a different view?
I think it's part of it, but what I'm saying is you're not being given a choice of people who could practically... do this. I mean, you're now paying somebody from whatever party £75,000 a year to be the police commissioner.
Which I think is mental, let's be honest.
It is. I think it's very difficult as well, because I would have thought one of the people who would be utterly brilliant as a police commissioner is somebody coming from a defence solicitor background, somebody who deals with the people who are out there committing crimes on a day-to-day basis, knows where the loopholes are, knows... how the law works, understands the law, and also potentially understands the failings of the police in a way that people on the other side perhaps don't quite so much.
Maybe.
And yet I can't imagine anybody out in the general public thinking, yes, we'll put a defence solicitor in charge of the police force, because of the image.
And the problem is,
ridiculous.
Of course, that it then becomes at least political, because it then becomes a matter of campaigning, and the only people who can afford to campaign are those who are supported by the major political parties. Mm. If it's not possible to have campaigning without major political party backing, endorsement and so on, is it a worthwhile role, full stop, or is it just a bloody big waste of money?
Just tinkering.
PR, I suppose. Crikey.
It's
well,
all about PR, isn't it? It's the same with this victims and sentencing.
Yeah.
No one's actually stopped to think what that's going to mean in neighbour disputes.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're not going to start thinking about it now. There you go. I imagine it's probably quite a long time, especially seeing as the rank you went when you left the police, but probably a very long time thinking back to how neighbour disputes used to work. They've not changed much. The idea of this being antisocial behaviour and out-of-court resolutions, as Theresa May, I think, called them. Scary stuff. Apparently, those are actually in, but that's a different matter. With all of those in place... really, does that make the police's job easier, trying to act as ringmaster between these ongoing battles between neighbours? I've loaded that question, I realise.
it's a role that I suspect the police now don't do.
Mm.
Certainly, I can't see any police officer being called to a normal neighbour, if there is such thing as a normal, but one without implications on the face of it. Neighbours dispute.
Yeah.
They'll just be told to sort it out.
Housing associations.
And PCSOs, I suppose. Yes. But even, the problem is PCSOs are now busy doing the jobs of PCs, because there's fewer PCs than there ought to be.
Right, finally, before we disappear, just a quick reminder that if you have not had a duty solicitor slot for more than 5 years, then the date for applying for your new slot is the 14th of November. You will also have to alert them by that date if anything's changed. So if you've got you've got a duty, remember to tell them that employees have left and employees have arrived at the firm.
I used to know what that firm was called now, and I really don't. Never mind. You'll know what it is if it applies to you, one would imagine. But yes, go and fill that form in. There's also some changes in relation to duty slots, which we will cover in a bit more detail when we have a bit more information about it. But in short, if you're a duty solicitor who's currently effectively selling your duty slot to a firm that you are associated to but not employed by,
You're not going to be able to.
Your days are numbered.
Yep. But if you, the good news is, if you are a firm and you've got, well, if you've got your slot and you've had it for more than 5 years and no changes, then you're safe till June 2013.
Unless they bring in some more rules.
No, they've announced that, 2013.
Yeah, they announce a lot of things. Well. Have you learned nothing in playing six series of this blooming show? All right, well, thank you very much, Terry, for joining us. Thank you very much, silent guest in the corner. Not so silent after all.
We knew we'd get her to talk.
Yeah, absolutely. Will you come back, Terry, at some point and talk to us?
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
If you want to contact the show, you can contact us by email, that is.
Mail at northpod.co.uk.
You can also find us on the Twitter. We are...
At Northpod Law.
And you can contact us by voicemail, 0161 408...
5037. I had it this week. Honestly, I never get a chance.
Thank you very much, and we'll join you again next week.
Bye-bye.